Tuesday, March the 18th. Looking at the front page, big words, fitting farewell. REO Speedwagon back where it all began. No better way for band members to say thank you than a hometown concert by Dave Hinton. Neil Doughty and Alan Grazier were neighbors, living across the hall from each other at the Illinois Street Residence Hall dormitory. They soon realized that they were both into music, and a jam session followed in the basement of the dorm. It was fall of 1966. More than 50 years later, Grazier, Doughty, and four other members of the band they were in will appear in a tribute event this summer at the State Farm Center. The duo were founding members of a little band you might have heard of, REO Speedwagon. The band with the unique name has sold more than 40 million records and had 13 top 40 hits. An event to honor the legacy of REO Speedwagon, back where it all began, is set for June 14th. Joining them will be former REO members Bruce Hall, Mike Murphy, Terry Luttrell, and Steve Scorfina. A video retrospective will include a memoriam to former members of the late Gary Richrath and the late Greg Philbin. All the stars are lining up to get everybody here, Hall said. This is going to be such a big production, sound-wise. It's going back home, and we want to say thank you and make it one full circle. The fans' feelings will no doubt be mutual. Word has spread quickly about REO's farewell event. I can tell you social media is exploding, said L.A. Fredrickson, co-host of the WKIO's radio's homegrown KIO program that features musical artists with a local flavor. People are saying that they are already buying concert tickets and airline tickets so they won't miss the event. The band's band was the brainchild of Doughty. The morning after the group decided it needed to come up with a name it was going to perform, Doughty had a light bulb moment. I had a class called The History of Transportation, he remembers. The word REO Speedwagon were written in pretty big letters on the blackboard, and that's the first thing I saw. Founder Ransom E. Olds, who later started Oldsmobile, created the Speedwagon. The group had a publicity photo taken and advertised in the campus newspaper, the Daily Illini. It wasn't long before they were called to perform at a fraternity. Besides keyboardist Doughty and drummer Grazier, original board members were Joe Matt, guitar and lead singer, and Mike Blair, bass guitar. Matt and Blair left the group at the end of the semester. When the group arrived for the gig, they noticed brown paper lining stuck on the nice wooden walls in their dining room because they had invited a sorority to this dinner and secretly had planned to start a food fight while the sorority was there, Doughty said. Music turned into flying mashed potatoes. Doughty said he remembers it took a day for Grazier to clean the potatoes out of his drum kit. The experience didn't sour the group. The gig paid them $40, money for music. Not a bad deal, they must have thought. The group performed all over the place. Its most frequent locale was Champagne's The Brown Jug, which is now a parking lot. Some nights, the band's share of the gate would be $4 apiece, but they didn't mind. They had all their room and board paid for at the U of I dorm. We played nothing but bars for years, and we loved it, Doughty said. A friend's station wagon was used to haul their equipment to gigs throughout the Midwest. Word spread that the group was pretty good. The Red Lion on campus was one of the top places in town to perform. A producer from New York, REO, used to pack the place in there, Fredrickson remembers. People were hanging from the rafters and everything else. Alan Grazier would tell me he would see people sitting in the rafters and he would think, we've really made it. He hadn't seen anything yet. Another we've made it experience came when the group played outdoors in Peoria before 3,000 people who didn't want to leave despite the pouring rain. A producer from New York happened to be there. We went up to him afterwards and said, you didn't hear our best material, Doughty said. He said, I'm hearing a crowd screaming in a downpour. That's all the producer I need. REO signed a record deal with Epic Records for its first album. It was 1971. Doughty said it took a year to record because the group was on the road so much. That love of electronics continued for Doughty, who bought every new musical gadget he could find. He was the player who brought the rousing Moog synthesizer opening to Riding the Storm out. REO's second album, REOTWO, much like that of the first album, featured more original material. One memorable aspect of the album's back cover is the photo of the group sitting in the counter of Vriner's Confectionery in downtown Champaign. We were friends with the Vriner's, Doughty said. Performing for Live Aid, a global televised charity event designed to help address a devastating famine in Ethiopia, yielded the group's biggest audience. Doughty called it an out-of-body experience. We played very early in the morning because it was being broadcast all over the world. The biggest names in music, they were all wandering around backstage, and I'm still in a daze from getting up so early. Don't worry, he said, there's only a billion people watching. The group's manager in the early days was Irvin Azoff, who also managed acts such as Steely Dan, Boz Scaggs, and Jimmy Buffett. Doherty said most of the band's first album was written in between sessions at the Red Lion. Another prominent place Doherty remembers playing is Chances Are. It was considered the premier place to play because the One-Eyed Jacks were there, and they had a limousine or signing autographs, he said. Doherty credited REO's set list, songs they heard on FM radio that no one else was hearing on their AM dials. The general public had not heard of artists like The Doors and The Youngbloods and Jimi Hendrix yet. A Chicago disc jockey ran a teen circuit in the suburbs and would regularly book REO. That guy kept us in rent money for years, Doherty said. Amazingly, we made our name by playing other people's material. Hall joined the band in 1977 in time for its golden period after playing with several local bands, including One-Eyed Jacks. REO was already on the West Coast when he got a call from the band's lead guitarist, Very Rich Rath, who didn't ask if he wanted to join. He told him he was. He told me I was going to join, Hall said. I'd worked with him before. He said, pack your bags, you're moving to California. We go on tour in 2 weeks. Hall said he saw Rich Rath develop as a guitarist. He's one of the best who ever was. Hall said he could play different ways, too. He wasn't just shredding all the time. Hall, who is 71, was the youngest member of the band and said REO's goal was basic. All the band wanted to do was write songs and play, and we did like to travel. I loved it. The 78-year-old Doherty said for him, being on the road again got old after a while, and being able to stay home has been a blessing physically. I just had a physical exam, he said. All the numbers that came back are the healthiest I've been in my life. I think it's because I got off of so much traveling, eating whatever food they gave you and their catering. I was just starting to feel more than run down. Doherty, who now lives in Minneapolis with his wife, Dara, and their three dogs, said REO decided to break up over a disagreement after Bruce Hall had to leave the band for a time to have back surgery. It was over a decision not to let Bruce back in the band, Doherty said. He said he wasn't going to let the band do that to his friend. Doherty spent his high school and college years in Belleville before matriculating to the U of I, where he had earned a scholarship in electrical engineering. As a kid, I had the basement, evil laboratory where I tinkered with everything, but never blew up the house. A lot of keyboard players are the tinkering kind of people. Hall, who was born and raised in Champaign, Urbana, and lived there till he was 23, now lives in Florida with his wife, Kimmy Sue, and is looking forward to returning to Champaign. It should be fun, he said. I love the fact the city of Champaign wanted to tell us thank you. There aren't too many rock bands out of Champaign, and we want to do the same. Say, thank you for this career and this life that we enjoy so much. Doherty said he and his wife, and Hall and his wife, will soon take a cruise together to celebrate Kimmy Sue's retirement. Hall said these days he enjoys spending time with his children and grandchildren. I sit around playing cards every day. I sing and play guitar, and I go fishing a lot. Doherty, who said he misses playing in front of a crowd, mostly plays these days for his wife and their three dogs, who say, I'm a really good piano player. And they have a picture here of an R.E. Olds, which is it's a panel side model, like a Model A truck. And it's where the REO Speedwagon got their name. The next article, Clark gets Dems nod as new treasurer. Champaign County Democrats, particularly those on the nominating committee, revealed the names of those seeking to fill the vacancy created by the February 28th resignation of Treasurer C.J. Johnson. The News Gazette previously disclosed the names of three of the applicants, Clark, Ingram, and Palmer. The fourth, Rhodes, wasn't revealed till Sunday. Another candidate, Donna Nelson, was expected by some to apply, but Nelson said she decided not to become a part of the process after considering pursuing the post. Sunday marked the second time that Ingram, a former recorder of deeds, has unsuccessfully sought appointment to an elective office. He previously sought the vacancy created by the death of State Senator Scott Bennett. Democrats ultimately chose Paul Faraci for the seat. All four of the candidates spoke to the Democrats and then answered questions. Clark gets Dems nod as new treasurer. Champaign County Democrats have selected local party member Brian Clark. Byron Clark as their choice to fill the vacant treasurer position. A weighted vote by precinct committee members Sunday night gave Clark a landslide victory, setting the stage for County Board Chair Jen Locke to submit his name for approval to the full board at Thursday's meeting. Clark was recommended choice of members of a special nominating committee. The choice was announced by Matt Sullard, second vice chair of the local party. Democrats then witnessed nominations of two other candidates who were publicly known, party chair Mike Ingram and former congressional candidate David Palmer. Champaign County State's Attorney Julie Reitz, who is also a member of the Democratic County Committee, made a surprise nomination of Andy Rhodes, the county's retired chief information officer, director. None of the three came close to Clark, who collected 3,895 of the possible 6,696 weighted votes cast by precinct committee members. Weighting voting refers to the number of Democrats in the precincts, some obviously more than others across Champaign County. Sunday was the first time that Democrats, particularly those on the nominating committee, revealed the names of those seeking the vacancy created by the February 25th referendum.
Oh, great. You can't talk, Ashley. You can't talk because I'm recording. You have to be quiet.
And on page 3, your threats will not intimidate us. Schiff dismisses Trump's attack on Biden pardons by Kevin Rechter. Senator Adam Schiff on Monday rebuffed as a baseless threat a weekend broadside from President Donald Trump, in which Trump alleged that Schiff and others could still face investigation for actions covered by a slate of late pardons. Your threats will not intimidate us, the California Democrat wrote on Twitter, or silence us. Schiff, elected last year to fill the seat long held by the late Senator Dianne Feinstein, is among those who received a pardon from Biden in the final days of his presidency, despite having personally discouraged the move. Schiff previously served in the House, where he helped lead the Select Committee to investigate the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol by Trump's supporters. The committee's work led to Trump being impeached by the House for a second time for inciting the insurrection, which was an attempt to block the transfer of power to Biden. Before leaving office, Biden issued a burst of pardons that he said were designed to protect individuals who had done nothing wrong, but who could nonetheless be targeted for retribution by Trump. That included the members of the Select Committee, including Schiff, one of Trump's most vociferous critics. Trump has lambasted Biden's pardons since they were issued, but he went a step further in a Sunday post on his social media platform, Truth Social, in which he adopted a conspiracy theory pushed online by right-wing pundits that Biden's pardons were invalid because they were signed using an auto pen, resulting in a digital, not handwritten signature. The theory ignores the fact that digital signatures are commonly used across the government and have been accepted for years, that other presidents have used auto pens to sign important measures and pardons, and that the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel under President George W. Bush issued a memorandum opinion justifying their use in 2005. The theory also plays on the notion that Biden, now 82, was mentally absent or overtly reliant on aides toward the end of his term. Elon Musk, Trump's broadly empowered government efficiency advisor and the world's richest man, posted on Sunday afternoon an image showing a line of presidential portraits with Biden's replaced with the image of an auto pen. Hours later, Trump, who edged out Biden as the oldest president to ever be in the inauguration in January, posted his remarks on Truth Social. The pardons that Sleepy Joe Biden gave to the unselect committee of political thugs and many others are hereby declared void, vacant, and of no further force or effect because of the fact they were done by auto pen, Trump wrote. In other words, Joe Biden did not sign them, but more importantly, he did not know anything about them. Trump also repeated claims he has previously made that the Select Committee deleted evidence in its witch hunt against him and said its members should fully understand that they are subject to investigation at the highest level. Trump's remarks were the latest indication that he intends to target Democrats for political retribution, since his repeated promises that his administration would bring an end to the political weaponization of the justice system. Trump has installed loyalists who backed his lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him at the highest levels of the Justice Department, increasing concerns that politically motivated investigations could be launched. Schiff said the members of the January 6th committee are all proud of our work. Representative Benny G. Thompson, a Mississippi Democrat and chair of the January 6th committee, echoed Schiff. Trump was responsible for January 6th. That's why on day one, he pardoned those who beat police that day. Thompson wrote on Twitter, referring to Trump's decision to pardon or grant clemency to those criminally charged in the insurrection. We thoroughly and illegally investigated what he did and have lived rent-free in his mind since. He knows his guilt, Thompson said. I'm not afraid of his rant. That is no basis in reality. And let's look at an article here called Picking Up the Pieces, which has to do with the severe weather, which we had part of. Picking up the pieces. 3-day outbreak of wildfires, dust storms, and tornadoes blamed for 42 deaths. Plantersville, Alabama. Kim Atchison was hunkered down in her grandmother's storm shelter with her 5-year-old grandson Saturday night in their tiny Alabama hometown of Plantersville when her husband and son raced in. Get down and get all the way down to the bottom of the cellar, they told her, saying they could see a twister coming. Atchison said she remembers the first dead silence and then hearing the wind that felt like a funnel and things outside hitting against each other. All was quiet after that because it was that fast, she said. Like a snap of a finger, and it was gone. Atchison and her family were among the fortunate ones to avoid being killed in the 3-day outbreak of severe weather across 8 states that kicked up a devastating combination of wildfires, dust storms, and tornadoes, claiming at least 42 lives since Friday. 2 people were killed by a twister in Plantersville. One was Annie Free, 82, who just looked out for everyone, said Atchison's husband, Darren. The tornado struck Free's home, leaving only the front patio behind. Darren Atchison spent Monday delivering granola bars and sports drinks to the plummeted neighborhood, driving his all-terrain vehicle around downed trees. More than 6 houses were destroyed, while others were left in rough shape, some with walls peeled clean off. The tornado flipped a trailer onto its roof and toppled trees in every direction. When Heidi Howland emerged from her home after hiding in her bedroom underneath a mattress with her husband, kids, and grandkids, as the twister approached, she found fallen trees and broken car windows. Many of her neighbors, whose houses were damaged, came to her front porch to take refuge from the rain after the storm passed Saturday night. One was Free's daughter, who Howland said cried late in the night because the first responders couldn't find her mother. Free's body wasn't found until the morning. Also killed was Dunk Pickering, a fixture in the community who often hosted 5 live music events and helped neighbors during rough times. Neighbor John Green found his body in the wreckage of a building just across the street from Green's home. Whether he knew you or not, he would help anyone, Green said. I've known him for 20 years. He's been like that ever since the day I first met him. Green and other neighbors spent at least 5 hours Saturday night pulling people from the rubble and carrying them to paramedics who were unable to reach the area because roads were blocked by debris. And there's a picture of Winterboro High School in Talladega County, Alabama. Looks like the gym's roof was ripped off totally. All that's left is one wall and some girders on a roof. We're lucky we didn't have more than we had here. This next article, let's see if I can get it on here, is from a Texas megachurch. Ex-pastor surrenders on charges of child sex abuse, from Oklahoma City. A former pastor of a Texas megachurch accused of child sexual abuse surrendered to Oklahoma authorities Monday. Robert Preston Morris, 63, turned himself in to officials in Osage County, where he was charged last week with 5 counts of lewd or indecent acts with a child. Phil Bachrach, a spokesman for the Oklahoma Attorney General's office, told the Associated Press. Court records show an Osage County judge set a $50,000 bond and ordered Morris to surrender his passport. Morris is expected to make an initial appearance before the judge at 11 a.m. May 9th, Macrack said. Attorney Mac Martin declined to comment on the charges, but said he anticipated entering a not guilty plea on Morris's behalf. Morris resigned last year as pastor of the Gateway Church in the Dallas suburb of South Lake, after a woman accused him of sexually abusing her in the 1980s. And now the town hall. Your questions, their answers. Spotlight on Champaign City Council District 3. Do you have something you've been wanting to ask the two candidates in April 1st lone contested Champaign County Council race? Pitting District 3 midterm appointee Jamar Brown against Shauna Claiborne. You come to the right place. Continuing a series we kicked off in December and are adding to this week, we'll take your questions directly to the candidates. Email questions to jdalessio@newsgazette.com. So they are asking County Board Member Matt Sullard, as federal executive orders continue to be asserted, some highly important to our university-driven community are those involving funding for diversity, equity, and inclusion, especially as it relates to grant funding. What is your position on the city's ability to navigate DEI-related executive orders while prioritizing the need for grants to support local programs, research, and jobs? So he has answers here from Jamar Brown. I'll start with him. As a candidate for Champaign City Council, I believe that diversity, equity, and inclusion are vital to our city's economic and social well-being, especially with our strong ties to the University of Illinois. Federal executive orders on DEI funding may present challenges, but they also reaffirm our commitment to equitable access to resources, research, and jobs. The city must take a proactive approach to ensure we maximize grant opportunities while complying with federal policies. This means working closely with the university, local businesses, and community organizations to secure funding that supports workforce development, education, and other community needs. If certain DEI-related grants face restrictions, we must look for alternative funding sources to ensure that our local programs remain strong. Champaign thrives when we invest in inclusive economic growth. By maintaining strong partnerships with federal, state, and private entities, we can navigate policy changes while staying true to our values. An inclusive Champaign is a stronger Champaign that benefits all residents while ensuring our city remains a leader in equity and opportunity. And Shauna Claiborne's answer. I grew up on Beardsley and McKinley Avenue in a neighborhood that embraced diversity. Black, Asian, interracial families, retirees, and young families. We had block parties, neighborhood watch, and a true sense of community. For me, diversity, equity, and inclusion isn't a buzzword. It's how we build a stronger, more inclusive Champaign. I've spent years on the front lines of DEI, first as a diversity professional at the University of Illinois, and then at my current position as Officer of Procurement and DEI at the State University's Retirement System, advocating for supplier diversity, fair policies, and investments that uplift historically marginalized communities. I'm not slowing down. That's why I'm running for City Council. This work matters now more than ever. Champaign has weathered job cuts and economic uncertainty, but this moment is different. Our economy depends on research funding, workforce pipelines, and thriving local businesses. We can't sit back. We have to stay proactive, especially with federal changes that could disrupt jobs and public funding. That means getting creative with funding and partnerships. We need to strengthen our work with groups like the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, collaborate with local organizations and research grants at every level. Public-private partnerships will be key to bringing in resources and keeping momentum when federal dollars run low. As your city council member, I'll stay focused on protecting jobs, expanding opportunity, and putting people first. The work may look different. It may not always be labeled DEI, but equity and inclusion will remain at the core of what we do. And now the spotlight on Savoy Village President. They are asking 24-year resident Ginger Mills, why should people who are moving to Champaign County choose to live in Savoy? And this is the answer from John Brown. Savoy is one of the fastest growing communities in Illinois and a great place to live and raise a family. We are strategically located in the Champaign Urbana metropolitan area, close to the University of Illinois' main campus, Research Park, South Farms, and Willard Airport. We have a very safe and diverse neighborhoods. According to recent data on neighborhoodsscout.com, Savoy is 67% safer than other cities in the U.S., including Champaign, safer than 17% of the cities, and Urbana, safer than 2%. The fire department has a great insurance service office rating, and recent changes to the staffing model have improved fire response times by 59%. Additionally, Savoy has one of the lowest municipal property tax rates in Champaign County. Without separate park district and or fire protection district property taxes are many fees common to other area communities, such as a 7% utility tax, 6% telecommunications tax, and or stormwater and recycling taxes. Savoy has beautiful parks, green spaces, and an ever-expanding network of shared-use paths. In the past 4 years, the village has received 2 grants for construction of these shared-use paths, which we hope to receive additional grant funding to implement further, along with our parks and green spaces. The village is also enhancing quality of life by addressing drainage issues through implementation of our stormwater master plan. Finally, construction begins soon on the Curtis Road grade separation and complete street project. Once completed, this project will improve transportation regionally, enhance safety, facilitate our economic growth, and further expand the shared use path network. And the other candidate, Jan Carter Necom. There are many reasons why living in Savoy. It has a small town feel with many housing and senior care options, and it is located next door to a great educational institution such as the University of Illinois and Parkland College. The 2 major healthcare facilities, Carl Foundation Hospital and OSF Heart of Mary Medical Center, along with Christie Clinic, are top quality. The Savoy area has a short commute times and provides convenient access to shopping and dining. Savoy transit modes include city and regional bus services, Amtrak, and Willard Airport. Access is convenient to 3 major interstate highways. The Savoy area has a short commute times and provides convenient access to shopping and dining. Savoy transit modes include city and regional bus services, Amtrak, and Willard Airport. Access is convenient to 3 major interstate highways, along with several state and federal routes. But why Savoy? Savoy's crime rate is relatively low. Parks are abundant and within village limits. Cycling and multi-use paths serve Savoy and connect the university and surrounding areas. More trails and paths are being built or being planned in the community. Savoy has a top-ranked fire department, and it receives its police services under a contract with the Champaign Sheriff's Office. The modern Savoy Recreation Center provides indoor recreation, options for people of all ages, including pickleball, a walking track, exercise equipment, group classes, programs for children and families, and a very popular summer camp. Savoy has a multiplex theater with IMAX, several eateries, a bakery, a donut shop, a craft beer venue, specialty shops, grocery stores, a Walmart, and a very popular and highly acclaimed elementary school. On top of these facts, Savoy's municipal tax rate is 20% lower than that of Champaign. And here's another one. Spotlight on Champaign Township Supervisor. The matchup, Republican incumbent Norman Davis versus Democratic challenger Leah Taylor. And what's the greatest challenge facing the township? And this is Davis's answer. The unwarranted push from the state legislature to consolidate small townships government is the government which is the closest and most responsive government for the people. It is also the most efficient and cost-effective form of government in Illinois. Big government is not more responsive, and it certainly is not the most efficient, and it is seldom cost-effective. You call my office. I will answer the phone, not a secretary. And Taylor, this is from Leah Taylor. She says, awareness. In my 17 years living in Champaign Township, most residents I've spoken with had no idea what happens, if anything, at the town hall building. They know we can bring yard waste there, but that's it. What made you want to run for this office at this time, Taylor? I first started thinking about it in 2022 when I drew the 2-year term when I was reelected to the Champaign County Board. During the years I was representing the county, I had a large number of District 5 constituents reaching out in frustration. They could never get anyone from the Champaign Township on the phone. The office is dark and looked locked, etc. Around that same time, I was called by a sobbing and terrified Champaign resident that knew me from my work on the county board. They were looking for resources to keep themselves and their child in their home, which they were weeks from losing. I was able to get them connected to the right people and resources, and through the city of Champaign Township, they didn't lose their home and are doing well today. To be able to be there, helping connect people with what they need to avoid homelessness, that was such a township, that was such a tangible good. And that's all we have time for today on part 1. I'll continue some of these interviews with you on part two. This is Kathy having a reading the News Gazette for Tuesday, March the 18th.